and welcome to Reading the Sioux City Journal for today, Monday, September 20th. I'm Ross, and I'm a volunteer. There's not a lot of local news. There's two local stories on the front page, and then a story about Charles Grassley. And then from that point on, it's pretty much going to be national news. There are no obituaries for today. So to begin, the weather forecast for the next couple days. Today it says a couple of showers, breezy and cooler, with winds from 10 to 20 miles per hour, a high of 68. For tonight, mainly clear and cooler with a low of 47. For Tuesday, partly sunny and breezy, high of 72 and a low of 44. For Wednesday, pleasant with plenty of sunshine, a high of 73 and a low of 49. For Thursday, breezy in the morning but mostly sunny, high of 78 and a low of 50. And then finally for Friday, partly sunny and pleasant with a high of 73 and a low of 44. For today, sunrise will be at 7:11 a.m. and sunset will be at 7:26. For tomorrow, sunrise will be 7:12 and sunset will be 7:24. All right, the FAQ for today. What is the dog in front of the Sioux City Journal office? That's Newshound. He was part of the Sioux City Art Center Public Arts Project several years ago. Using a mold of Seaman, the dog who accompanied Lewis and Clark on their expedition, an artist gave our version a journalistic flair. You can see other Seaman and other dogs around town. By the way, I think some of them still exist. The online poll for today was, have you ever been in a marching band? That's an interesting question. I have a feeling it has to do with Starfest, which is one of the front page stories. Yesterday's question was, do you believe in ghosts? 48 people responded to that, and 46%, just shy of half, said yes, they believe in ghosts, and 54% said no, they don't believe in ghosts. Today's speak-out question is, what's your reaction to the City of Sioux City's proposal to contribute $200,000 over the next 2 years to the new Regional Convention and Visitors Bureau? You can sound off at facebook.com/SiouxCityJournal. That speak-out question relates to today's front-page story about the Sioux City City Council. Headline says, Council to vote on Visitors Bureau funds. $200,000 would be used to boost Sioux City tourism. The Sioux City Council will be asked Monday to approve a letter of understanding to authorize the payments totaling $200,000 to the Regional Convention and Visitors Bureau so that the Bureau can continue to recruit new events and promote Sioux City as a destination for tourists, conventions, and sporting events. If the Council votes in favor of the proposed resolution, the city will make two $100,000 payments to the Sioux City Regional Convention and Visitors Bureau on October 1st of 2021 and 2022. Throughout the rest of the story, they refer to the Convention and Visitors Bureau by its acronym. I'm just going to say Visitors Bureau for the rest of the story. Andrew Nilgis, Visitors Bureau Board President, told the Journal Friday that he's optimistic about the Bureau's future. We're a new organization, so there's been a lot to tackle. I'm optimistic in the direction that we're heading in, Nilgis said. I would anticipate that we'll continue to build the organization, continue to have success in bringing events to Sioux City and the Siouxland area. Nilgis said Christy Franz began working as executive director of the Visitors Bureau roughly a month ago. The Bureau announced its first hire, Ron Bauer, in late January. However, Nilgis said Bauer, who was recruited from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, to serve as destination manager for tourism, resigned a number of months ago. Nilgis explained, at some point in the future, to get a second person and continue growing the staff is something that is on our radar. I wouldn't say that it's going to happen immediately, but hopefully in the not-so-distant future, we'll be able to do that. Under the terms of the agreement with the city, the Visitor Bureau will present an annual budget to member cities and stakeholders with a public relations plan which promotes Sioux City and participating members and recruits new events to Sioux City. The Bureau will also continue to build a membership base by recruiting more hoteliers and businesses as stakeholders maintain a website and social media presence and update listings of all restaurants, retail, entertainment, establishments, and events. Other duties include distributing press releases and promoting a calendar of events to statewide media outlets, assuming all CVB responsibilities from the city, such as applying for applicable tourism grants, funding membership and actively participating in regional and state tourism associations and programs, and keeping the council and city staff up to date on the latest happenings surrounding the operation on at least a biannual basis. Local leaders refocused their tourism efforts after Sioux City eliminated the city department that oversaw not only tourism, but also the Tyson Event Center and the Convention Center. The change occurred after the city hired Spectra, a Philadelphia-based venue management firm, to run the Tyson 3 years ago. The Convention and Visitors Bureau Board manages the new CVB, while the Events Facilities Advisory Board continues to oversee the city-owned venues. In August of 2020, the Sioux City Council unanimously approved a memorandum of understanding to authorize quarterly $25,000 contributions to the Visitor Board for 1 year. The Visitors Board is primarily funded through a 1.65% lodging fee paid by guests at hotels in Sioux City, South Sioux City, North Sioux City, and Dakota Dunes that have opted in. The fee is in addition to the 7% hotel motel tax collected on all rooms in Sioux City. Half of that 7% tax is currently earmarked for tourism purposes, while the other half goes to the city's general fund. According to city documents, the Visitors Board total income for fiscal year 2022 is $366,000. The room fee accounts for $216,000 of total income, while city partnerships contribute $135,000, membership, marketing, $10,000, and donations, grants, etc., $5,000. The Visitors Board's total expenses match its income. The bulk of its $366,000 income is allocated towards staff, $160,000, and sales expenses, $92,000. I just realized I forgot to read the mini editorial for today. Jeff Janes of Sioux City is the author of today's mini editorial, and he writes, "Congratulations, because you choose not to vaccinate or wear a mask, Woodbury County is back up to almost 15% positivity rate, and we've gone from roughly 5 to 6 cases a week in June to 415 in the last week. Stay true to your freedom to infect others. Good job." And that was the mini editorial today from Jeff Janes. The other front page story of local interest is about Starfest. It says Starfest matches back. And there's a couple of nice pictures of youngsters out flying flags and directing marchers. There's a sidebar box that says, "If you go, the 23rd annual Starfest marching band competition will be hosted by North High School. It begins at noon Saturday with competition between 14 regional schools throughout the day. The final competition will begin at 6:30 p.m. A 9:30 p.m. award presentation will complete the event, and this is held at Elwood Olsen Stadium at 3201 Peters Avenue near the Morningside University campus." All right, so headline says, "North High Marching Band prepares for 23rd annual contest." At 6:45 a.m. most weekday mornings, band director Kamal Talukder gets to see the sun rise from the field at North High School. Talukder says, "It's always a beautiful thing to experience." And he notes that he and all of the members of the North High School Marching Band are busy practicing music long before classes begin. And then he also says the students get here early. They have to really commit to be in band. North's band will be hosting the 23rd annual Starfest Marching Band Competition beginning at noon Saturday at Elwood Olsen Stadium on the campus of Morningside University. 14 regional marching bands, some from as far away as Sioux Falls, will be competing in such categories as music performance, music general effect, and marching execution. Percussion and color guard will also be judged in separate categories. Talukder says, "It will be great for my students to see what other schools are doing. There are things we do that may be different than other schools, plus there may be things we'll need to work on." Talukder noted that the band members are simply happy that Starfest is going on at all. "We couldn't have the competition last year due to COVID-19, he explained. "Our kids missed out on all of it. Plus, this year, freshmen and sophomore musicians will get to experience Starfest for the first time. But at Starfest, everything is a group effort." Talukder says the students are involved in every aspect of Starfest, and so are our parent volunteers. "This is because the competition is, literally, an all-day event. Competitions will be taking place throughout the day, with the final contest slated to begin at 6:30 p.m. Starfest will conclude with an award competition at 9:30 p.m. "All of the hard work is beneficial for students," Talukder said. "They are developing a work ethic, acquiring time management skills while gaining self-confidence. All of this will come in handy no matter what they do in the future. More than that, the students are making memories that will last a lifetime." And then Talukder concludes the story by saying, "The experiences and the friendship made in band will stick with them forever." All right, we're now on to Associated Press stories. On the front page, there's a headline that says, "Dems push to retool U.S. health care." And this is byline from Washington. "Dental work for seniors on Medicare, an end to sky's the limit pricing on prescription drugs, new options for long-term care at home, coverage for low-income people locked out of Medicaid by ideological battles." Those are just some of the changes to health care that Democrats want to achieve with President Joe Biden's massive Build Back Better plan. The $3.5 trillion domestic agenda bill touches all aspects of American life, from taxes to climate change, but the health care components are a cornerstone for Democrats, amplified during the COVID-19 crisis. For the nearly 145 million Americans covered by government health programs, along with their families and communities, the investment in the nation's services could make a difference in the quality of life for decades. Kathleen Sebelius, federal health secretary under President Barack Biden, said it's a holistic look at how health care can be not just expanded, but better directed to the needs that people actually have. "You've got a plan that's really aimed at the serious gaps in healthcare that are still causing people to either go totally uninsured or run out of money in the course of their treatments." And that was Kathleen Sebelius. But Democrats can only succeed if they bridge divisions among themselves. Don't look for Republicans to help. With Medicare's long-term finances under a cloud, Republicans say now is not the time to add new benefits. They are planning to oppose not just the health care provisions, but the entire Biden package, voting lockstep against it as too big, costly, and a slide towards socialism. Mindful of the politics ahead, Democrats are assembling the package with their slim hold on Congress. Instead of launching new experiments that many progressives prefer, they have chosen to plow more resources into existing programs, from Medicare and Medicaid, enacted during the Great Society, to the Obama-era Affordable Care Act. It's a compromise of sorts, led by Biden's approach, paid for by taxes on corporations and the wealthy, those earning more than $400,000, as well as savings on prescription drug prices paid by the government to the pharmaceutical companies. Biden said, "I've said many times before, I believe we're at an inflection point in this country, one of those moments where the decisions we're about to make can change, literally change, the trajectory of our nation for years and possibly decades to come." Polling has shown that core healthcare provisions appeal to voters across political lines. many Republican voters, for example, generally approve of Medicare negotiating prescription drug prices, even if GOP lawmakers do not. While the Obama health law focused mainly on helping uninsured working-age people and their families, Biden's CODA puts a big emphasis on older people who also happen to be reliable midterm election voters. Major health care provisions in the mix include authorizing Medicare to negotiate prices for the costliest drugs, including insulin. Private insurers and employer plans could then access those lower prices. Annual price increases for established drugs would be limited. Seniors' out-of-pocket costs would be capped. A RAND Corporation study finds such an approach could cut U.S. spending on top drugs by half. Sharp opposition from the big pharmaceutical companies and key business industry groups have left Democrats divided over the structure of the program. Four House Democrats opposed the measure during committee votes last week, enough to tank the entire bill. In the past, they had supported giving Medicare authority to negotiate, but they are expressing a range of concerns about the scope of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's plan. The Senate could take a somewhat different approach. Medicare negotiating authority is the linchpin of the health care package because expected savings would be used to provide new benefits. The proposal also includes Medicare to cover dental care, vision, and hearing aids for seniors. This provision, championed by Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, has been a long time coming. Vision care would begin the latter part of next year and hearing aids in 2023. But in an apparent concession to costs, dental coverage would not start until 2028. Biden also wants to build on Obama health law. The idea is to provide health insurance to more than 2 million low-income people in GOP-led states that have rejected the Medicaid expansion of Obamacare. The workaround is a top health equity demand for black lawmakers because many of those caught in the coverage gap are minorities in southern states. Biden's plan also calls for making health insurance more affordable for people who buy their own policies by extending a subsidy boost for Obama's health law. The president wants to promote a shift to long-term care in the patient's own home as opposed to nursing facilities, which turned into incubators for the coronavirus as the pandemic spread. Biden had wanted $400 billion for this initiative under Medicaid, but it looks like Congress will give him about half of that. Plans also include permanently funding the politically popular Children's Health Insurance Program, so it's not subject to recurring votes in Congress that could disrupt services. With key central Democrats saying the overall $3.5 trillion price tag is too high, Democrats are looking for ways to cut costs, either by eliminating some programs or, more likely, shaving some costs or duration off what has been proposed. Other Democrats, though, warned that a slimmer package might disappoint voters who sent them to Washington. Representative Lauren Underwood of Illinois said, "My constituents are expecting me to deliver, and I'm committed to doing it." Moving on to the state and local page, there's a headline that says, "Grassley wary of cocaine penalty reforms. Iowa Republican won't go below 18-1 sentencing ratio for crack." U.S. Senator Charles Grassley believes he's earned his bona fides on criminal justice reform. As chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, the Iowa Republican sponsored the First Step Act, a sweeping criminal justice bill that made a number of reforms aimed at reducing recidivism and improving conditions in federal prisons. Now, as ranking member of the committee, he's teaming with the chairman, Illinois Democratic U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, to tackle sentencing reform. However, he may not be willing to go as far as a broad coalition of justice reform advocates who want to eliminate the federal sentencing disparity between crack and powder cocaine, which they point out has disproportionately impacted people of color. Under a 1986 law, those convicted in federal court of possessing small amounts of crack face the same sentences as those possessing 100 times as much powder cocaine. Grassley co-sponsored legislation that changed that 100-to-1 sentencing ratio for crack versus powder cocaine to 18-to-1 and says he's not unwilling to consider further changes. He believes, however, that other factors, recidivism, addiction, and violent crime, must be considered in reforms. Reforms must be fair and just, but prioritize public safety, Grassley said in a Judiciary Committee hearing earlier this summer. I think he's scratching at the right set of concerns, public safety being the first one, said Patrick Puttrell, Director of Legislative Affairs for the National Faith and Freedom Coalition, which advocates for free market, limited government, and public policy consistent with Christian values. But the disparity had increased the federal prison population and costs, as well as unintentionally created racial disparities in federal sentencing. And that was all a quote from Puttrell, I believe. Citing a poll showing nearly three-quarters of Iowa voters favor eliminating the sentencing disparity, Puttrell believes data and public opinion are on the side of the coalition, which is part of the Justice Action Network. It includes groups as diverse as the American Civil Liberties Union and the American Legislative Exchange Council, associations representing prosecuting attorneys, as well as criminal defense lawyers and faith-based groups. The Justice Action Network has endorsed the Equal Act, which would eliminate the sentencing disparity. It has been approved by the House Judiciary Committee 35-6. That bipartisan support is consistent with the findings of a poll commissioned by the network that found 74% of Iowa voters, including 70% of strongly conservative voters and 68% of former President Donald Trump voters, support the Equal Act. That doesn't surprise Tim Head, Executive Director of Iowa Faith and Freedom Coalition. It shows, among other things, he said, that momentum for bipartisan criminal justice reform has not waned since Trump signed Grassley's First Step Act. And then Head says, when 74% of Iowa voters support this common sense bipartisan criminal justice reform legislation, it's not just sound policy, it's smart politics. And then Head said the support was, frankly, a number that I wouldn't have predicted. But the Equal Act doesn't have that level of support in the Senate, Grassley said. Attempting to eliminate the disparity would jeopardize the likelihood he and Durbin can get the 60 votes needed to bring the justice reform bills to the floor. Among Republican colleagues, it's a non-starter, he said. Does that mean that there's not some possibility for compromise? I would be open to that, but I'm going to have to get enough Republicans to go along to make sure we don't scuttle the other good provisions we have, Grassley said. He's aware that in 2017, the Iowa legislature reduced the state's sentencing disparity for crack and powder cocaine from 10-to-1 to 2.5-to-1. However, he doesn't see that as relevant in the congressional discussion. Winning support for sentencing reform has become more difficult because of increases in crime in a number of cities, Grassley said. The environment isn't quite as good now as it was when he was able to get the First Step Act passed after 4 years of work. Grassley and the Justice Action Network come armed to the debate with data. To Grassley, it shows that crack cocaine and powder cocaine offenses differ in terms of violence and the likelihood offenders commit additional crimes in the future. He cites the U.S. Sentencing Commission, which found weapons were involved in 38.9% of crack cocaine cases, compared with 18.4% in marijuana and powder cocaine cases. It also found that overall, crack cocaine offenders had more serious criminal histories than any other group of drug traffickers. Puttrell counters that with a National Institutes of Health report that found that crack cocaine use itself is not a cause or predictor of violence once demographic factors are controlled for. The Sentencing Commission also found, however, that crack cocaine offenders recidivate at the highest rate of any drug type at 60.8%, while powder cocaine offenders recidivate at the lowest rate of 43.8%. That in itself is not a reason to continue the disparity, Puttrell argued. Recidivism rates writ large are terrible, he said. Puttrell credits Grassley's First Step Act with addressing prison programming in ways to break the recidivism cycle and advocates for doing more in prison and during supervised release to encourage better behavior, such as reinvesting the savings services that with reduce recidivism, such as mental health and substance abuse treatment. That's geek speak for just saying increase public safety, because obviously the less recidivism we have, the less crime we're going to have, the more public safety we're going to have, Puttrell continued. Removing the safe sentencing disparity does not prevent prosecutors from seeking penalties when crack cocaine offenses involved weapons of violence, he added. We're about 25 minutes into today's reading. We're going to move now to the Nation page, where there is a Midwest story, if nothing else. The headline says, Minneapolis police begin new training initiative. Officers will learn how to intervene in excessive use of force. Minneapolis police are launching a department-wide training program designed to show officers how to intervene when one of their own is using excessive force, more than 1 year after George Floyd was murdered by an officer in the presence of three other officers. The program, adopted by about 180 police departments across the United States, is called ABLE, A-B-L-E, short for Active Bystander for Law Enforcement, and can help transform the culture of a department, advocates say. Professor Christy Lopez, co-director of the Innovative Police Programming at Georgetown University Law School, she said one of the things that active bystandership teaches officers is how to step in and have hard conversations with officers when they are doing the wrong thing. Sometimes that wrong thing is using too much force or arresting someone that shouldn't be arrested. ABLE officials notified Minneapolis police leaders in late July that the department had been accepted into the program. Some officers who will conduct the training will get trained this month, said attorney Jonathan Aroney, co-founder of ABLE and a partner in the D.C. law firm of Shepard Mullen. The training comes at a difficult time for the Minneapolis Police Department, which could be replaced with a new public safety department if voters approve a ballot measure in November. ABLE is being rolled out nearly 3 months after former officer Derek Chauvin was sentenced to 22 and a half years in prison for Floyd's murder, and 6 months before a scheduled second trial for the three officers who were also on the scene. All four officers pleaded not guilty Tuesday to federal charges that they deprived Floyd of his constitutional rights. Aroney, who also co-chairs ABLE's advisory board, said that whatever the department's future, Minneapolis officers still need to know how to successfully engage in street interventions with their peers. The three officers charged with complicity in Floyd's death are expected to argue they never were trained in how to stop another officer, especially a senior officer like Chauvin, from using undue force. The program teaches officers how to stop higher-ranking officers who are behaving improperly. An ABLE memorandum posted last year noted that policies requiring officers to intervene, which were on the books in Minneapolis at the time Floyd was killed, are not enough to save lives in the real world. Lopez, who led U.S. Justice Department investigations of police departments during the Obama administration, is quoted as saying that police need to be taught how to intervene. In an interview, Lopez said, ABLE also teaches police how to step in if a male officer treats a female colleague in a demeaning way, or if another officer spouts a racial stereotype about a neighborhood. She said she hopes Minneapolis police will allow Georgetown or an independent entity to study ABLE's impact on the department. Lopez says, it is always hard for a department under the spotlight like this to implement these sorts of interventions well because of defensiveness, skepticism, and cynicism coming from within the department. A lot of it is warranted. Spurred by Floyd's death, the ABLE training program has swept the country. Among the cities whose departments have signed on are New York, Washington, D.C., Boston, Baltimore, Denver, Seattle, and Portland, Oregon, plus sheriff's departments and other law enforcement entities. Aroney said about 140,000 officers are scheduled to get the training. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey and Police Chief Madaria Arredondo submitted letters of application to ABLE in July. ABLE training is an important next step in fostering a culture of peer intervention to prevent misconduct and encourage officer wellness, Frey said in a statement to the Star Tribune. This work reflects our city's values and our commitment to the goal of a safe community for everyone. ABLE is adapted from a program developed in New Orleans in 2015 called EPIC, Ethical Policing is Courageous. It was implemented after New Orleans police agreed to federal mandates to reform following major civil rights violations and police misconduct. The St. Paul Police Department developed its own version of EPIC before Floyd was killed and began training officers in it last year. St. Paul's program is not affiliated with ABLE. The program uses role-playing to teach how to intervene gently at first with a tap on a shoulder and more forcefully if needed. ABLE is a 20-hour program stretching over 4 days that requires 2 certified trainers for classes of no more than 25 people at a time. In some cities, veteran ABLE instructors visit the department to co-teach the first few courses. Ted Quant, a social justice activist from New Orleans who's been both a critic of police conduct and a supporter of ABLE, has said the program could have saved George Floyd's life and many other lives. Irvin Staub, professor emeritus of psychology at the University of Massachusetts, who developed the theory of bystandership, has noted that when Chauvin had his knee on Floyd's neck, rookie officer Thomas Lane asked if they should roll Floyd on his side. Chauvin said no, but Staub said the 3 officers watching could have stopped him if they had been trained. Defense attorney Earl Gray, who represents Lane and says his client tried to intervene twice, noted that while the police department says officers had a duty to intervene, they never had any scenario-based training on how to do so. In the Chauvin trial, prosecutors argued that any reasonable officer, regardless of rank, would have intervened when confronted with such a glaring example of excessive force. But some department critics insist that no amount of training will prevent a similar incident unless the department's culture changes. People do intervene without training, but it shouldn't take exceptional courage, said Joel Davoskin, a psychologist and a professor at the University of Arizona College of Medicine. Delving deeper into the paper, we are on the Nation and World page now. This is a story headlined Climate and Virus Top Agenda, World Leaders to Gather This Week in New York for Annual Event. And this is bylined the United Nations. Last year, no leaders came at all. This year will be quite different, sort of. With the coronavirus pandemic still raging in many parts of the world, leaders from more than 100 nations are heading to New York this week for the United Nations annual high-level gathering, a COVID-inflected, semi-locked-down affair that takes place in one of the pandemic's hardest-hit cities of all. It will be a departure from the last in-person meeting of the General Assembly in 2019 and far different, too, from last year's all-virtual version. Awaiting them, daunting challenges enough to scare anyone who runs a country, from an escalating climate crisis and severe vaccine inequities to Afghanistan's future under its new Taliban rulers and worsening conflicts in Myanmar and the Tigray region of Ethiopia. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has pointed to many other signs of a more chaotic, insecure, and dangerous world. Rising poverty and hunger, technology's advances without guardrails like lethal autonomous weapons, the risks of climate breakdown and nuclear war, and growing inequality, discrimination, and injustice bringing people into the streets to protest while conspiracy theories and lies fuel deep divisions within societies. The UN chief keeps repeating that the world is at a, quote, pivotal moment and must shift gears to a greener and safer world. To do that, leaders need to give multilateralism teeth. but as is often true with the United Nations, it remains to be seen whether the high-level meetings, which start Monday and end September 27, make actual progress. After COVID-19 forced leaders to deliver remote, pre-recorded speeches at last year's meeting, more than 100 heads of state and government and more than 24 ministers decided to come to New York this year despite the pandemic. That reflects the United Nations' unique role as a global town square for all 193 member countries, whether tiny or vast, weak or powerful. The Assembly's annual gathering of world leaders, called the General Debate, has always been a place where presidents, prime ministers, monarchs, and other top officials can discuss local, regional, and global concerns at public or private meetings and receptions and over lunches and dinners. Richard Gowen, UN Director of the International Crisis Group, said the General Assembly's first in-person meeting since the pandemic began is an opportunity to show that international cooperation matters. After 4 years of Donald Trump represented the United States at the meetings, this week we'll see Joe Biden make his first appearance as president at Tuesday's opening of the General Debate. Gowen said he won't be as forthright in criticism of China as Trump was, especially in 2019 and 2020, but I think Biden will try and cast China as a country that is challenging the rules-based world order and a country that should not be trusted with leadership of the international system. There are a couple of shorter stories on the World Nation page. One is bylined Three Rivers, California. And the headline says, Firefighters Battle to Save Ancient Sequoia Groves. Hot, dry weather on Sunday added to the challenges facing California firefighters battling to keep flames from driving further into a grove of ancient sequoias, where the base of the world's tallest tree has been wrapped in protective foil. Meanwhile, flames had reached the giant trees in another grove. Fire officials warned that stronger winds were also contributing to critical fire conditions in the area of the KNP complex, two lightning-sparked blazes that merged on the western side of Sequoia National Park in the Sierra Nevadas. The National Weather Service issued a red flag warning through Sunday, saying gusts and lower humidity could create conditions for rapid wildfire spread. Fires forced the evacuation of the park last week, along with parts of Three Rivers, a foothill town of about 2,500 people. Firefighters using bulldozers expanded a line between the fire and the community, fire spokesman Rebecca Patterson said Sunday. More than 34 square miles of forest land have been blackened. The National Park Service said Friday that fire had reached the westernmost tip of the giant forest, where it scorched a grouping of sequoias known as the Four Guardsmen that marked the entrance to the grove of 2,000 sequoias. Since then, crews have managed to keep the flames from encroaching further into the area. Firefighters swaddled the base of the General Sherman tree, along with other trees in the giant forest, in a type of aluminum that can withstand high heat. The General Sherman tree is the largest in the world by volume at 52,500 cubic feet, according to the National Park Service. It towers 275 feet high and has a circumference of 103 feet at ground level. Firefighters who were wrapping the base of the sequoia in foil and sweeping leaves and needles from the forest floor around the trees had to flee from the danger, fire spokesperson Katie Hooper said Saturday. Giant sequoias are adapted to fire, which can help them thrive by releasing seeds from their cones and creating clearings that allow young sequoias to grow. But the extraordinary intensity of fires fueled by climate change can overwhelm the trees. Another story from the West, this one bylined Moose, Wyoming, is headlined Petito's Body Likely Found in Wyoming. Authorities say a body discovered Sunday in Wyoming is believed to be Gabrielle Gabby Petito. The FBI said the body was found by law enforcement agents who had spent the past 2 days searching campgrounds. The cause of death has not yet been determined, said FBI Supervisory Special Agent Charles Jones. Jones said investigators are seeking information from anyone who may have seen Petito or Brian Laundrie around some camping sites located on Grand Teton National Park's eastern boundary, the same site that was the subject of law enforcement search over the weekend. Petito and her boyfriend Laundrie left in July on a cross-country trek in a converted van to visit national parks in the U.S. West. Police say Laundrie was alone when he drove the van back to his parents' home in Northport, Florida on September 1st. Laundrie has been identified as a person of interest in the case. He was last seen Tuesday by family members in Florida. There are a couple of sports stories of local interest, I guess, for this morning. One is headlined, Helan claims second at CYO. Class 1A number 3 Galen wins tournament. The Bishop Helan High School volleyball team earned a key confidence boost on Sunday. The Crusaders won their final match during the CYO tournament against Kemper Catholic at O'Gorman Fieldhouse, and with the victory, they placed second behind Galen Catholic. Helan dropped the first set to the Knights 21-15, and it seemed like Kemper had the momentum needed to walk away with a number 2 spot among the Catholic schools. However, the Crusaders started to serve the ball a lot better, and that helped them take some of that mojo back. Helan coach Lauren Brobst said, "They really put the pressure on them serving-wise, and our serve-receive was very good." The Crusaders won the second set 21-15 and then won the decisive third set 17-15. Kemper sophomore Franny Glynn hit the ball long as she tried to clip the back right corner behind the Crusaders. That last set was back and forth throughout the set from the 4-4 mark. Crusader senior Jocelyn Verzel said, "We just needed to play together as a team. We needed to have confidence that we needed to do this. This will be some great momentum for us coming up for our next games." Freshman Malia Hacker and Lauren LaFleur both had 6 kills during the win over Kemper, while Verzel had 5. Moving to the golf course, there's a headline that says Clark wins in Sioux Falls. Darren Clark won the Stanford International on Sunday for his third PGA Tour Championship victory of the season, beating KJ Choi with a birdie on the second hole of a playoff. Clark, the 53-year-old major champion from Northern Ireland, closed with a 5-under-65 at Minnehaha Country Club, birdie-ing the par four 18th to match Choi and Steve Flesch at 12-under-198. Clark said, "It's nice to get back in the winner's circle. In the playoff, you never know what's going to happen. Anybody can make birdie, and luckily it was my day today." Clark won the Timber Tech Championship in November for his first senior title and took the Mitsubishi Electric Championship in January on his next tour start. "I've really enjoyed my time here in Sioux Falls," Clark said. "The fans have been brilliant. I've had maybe a little beverage with one or two of them in the past, so it's been nice to have that atmosphere and the support. It's always wonderful." Choi, the second round leader, finished with a 69. He had only one birdie on the par for 13th. Choi said, "Playoff in the second hole, hit the tree at the left. Is disappointing, but good finish. Everything is very great this week." Flesch eliminated with a bogey on the first extra trip down 18, also bogeyed the hole in regulation for a 66. "I played well. I've been playing well," Flesch said. "I just wish I could have played that 72nd hole over. I picked an aggressive line and made kind of a tentative swing with the 3-wood, and it got me. You know that 18th hole, it's playing tough. Straight downwind, it's hard to get the ball on the right level." Miguel and Hal Jimenez, the 2020 winner, was 2 strokes back, along with Rod Pampling. U.S. Ryder Cup captain Steve Stricker was 9 under. Stricker will lead the United States against Europe next week at Whistling Straits in Wisconsin. Retief Goosen was 8 under with Alex Sheka, John Senden, and Stephen Aker. I'm going to jump now into the e-edition, which is all featurey type stuff in the Sioux City Journal's electronic edition. This one is headlined, Back to the Doctor's Office. The pandemic has disrupted preventive care. Here's how to get back on track. And this was originally printed in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Have you overlooked or postponed your health checkups during the unending 20-month pandemic? A new study suggests that U.S. cancer diagnoses have declined because of pandemic-related upheaval. The average monthly number of newly identified cases of 8 types of cancer plunged almost 30% during the early pandemic shutdowns, then rebounded when medical practices reopened, but fell again last winter by 19%. Skipping screenings and checkups could lead to diagnosis of cancer at later stages, which could lead to poorer outcomes, the study authors wrote in an August JAMA Network Open. And it's not just cancer. The pandemic has disrupted diagnosis and preventative care of diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, heart disease, depression, and many other conditions, especially for those who struggled to access quality care before the pandemic. We know that COVID-19 unfortunately shed a light on the many disparities in healthcare that existed, and then it added another, said Delena Wardlow, a Temple Health primary care physician who was named 2020 Pennsylvania Family Physician of the Year. People who have poorly controlled or diagnosed illness are at higher risk of severe COVID-19 and death. A year ago, Wardlow and her twin sister, pediatrician Elena McDonald, launched Twin Sisters Docs, accessible at the twinsisterdocs.com and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, to promote wellness, self-advocacy, and address health disparities in the underserved communities where they have worked for 2 decades. Jefferson Health's Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center also recently launched an effort to better serve vulnerable populations in the Philadelphia region, a mobile cancer screening van funded with a $1.4 million gift from Dietz & Watson, the delicatessen meat maker. Initially, the mobile unit is offering mammograms to detect breast cancer, but will eventually offer screenings for prostate, head and neck, and skin cancers. If you have no particular pains or problems, it is easy to adopt the attitude that it's not broken, so don't fix it. But a healthier attitude is, you can't fix what you don't know about. Here is a rundown of preventive health screenings and you should get even in a pandemic. All right, so the first one is colon cancer. It says no one wants a colonoscopy, but this screening test truly prevents colorectal cancer because the physician can find and remove precancerous polyps. A first colonoscopy is now recommended at age 45 instead of 50 because colorectal cancer has been increasing among younger adults, especially in Black patients. The interval for a repeat colonoscopy varies depending on risk factors and the results of the first screen. Stool tests are at-home alternatives for screening, but positive results could lead to a colonoscopy. And then there's one here that says, for women, breast and cervical cancer screening guidelines have evolved. Leading organizations say that average risk women age 55 and older can get mammograms every 2 years rather than annually if results show no evidence of cancer. So you may be within the recommended interval even if you skipped your mammogram last year. Pap smears, which used to be done annually, are no longer recommended more often than every 3 years, and if you add a screening test for HPV, the virus that causes cervical cancer, you can wait 5 years after initial results to screen again. For men, prostate cancer screening advice has also changed. Men should talk to their doctors about the pros and cons of routine PSA blood tests. For higher risk men, that includes Black men, screening may be prudent, but experts say the risks of detecting and treating an inconsequential tumor should be discussed. For skin cancer, including melanoma, the most dangerous kind is linked to sun and sun lamp exposure, skin type, and age. If you are fair-skinned or have been treated for basal or squamous cell skin cancer, monthly self-checks and annual checks by a physician are a good idea. Rates of all types of skin cancer have been rising for 30 years. And then it just says other screening tests. Routine blood pressure and blood cholesterol checks are important because abnormal levels usually cause no symptoms until cardiovascular damage develops. The same for diabetes, which can damage organs throughout the body if not diagnosed and controlled. Many people with high blood sugar don't know it because they haven't had an AIC or A1C test to check their level after fasting. So-called pre-diabetes can often be reversed with improved diet and weight loss. If it progresses to diabetes, make sure you get your A1C checked, Wardlow said. If you need medication, it can be initiated or adjusted. Thyroid function tests are usually done based on symptoms or because a doctor feels a lump at the base of the neck where the gland is located. A surprisingly varied list of symptoms, including weight loss or gain, heart flutters, severe constipation, and hand tremors, may signal thyroid problems. The American Thyroid Foundation says adults over 35 should be checked once every 5 years. Finally, bone density screening for osteoporosis, done with an X-ray called DEXA, is recommended for women at age 65 and for younger women with certain risk factors, including having a parent with history of hip fractures. I'm going to read another health-related story, at least a little bit of it, and then move on to Dear Abby to conclude the morning reading. The headline on this story says, Religious COVID-19 Vaccine Exemptions Being Questioned. An estimated 2,600 Los Angeles Police Department employees are citing religious objections to try to get out of the required COVID-19 vaccination. In Washington state, thousands of state workers are seeking similar exemptions. And in Arkansas, a hospital has been swamped with so many such requests from employees that it is apparently calling their bluff. Religious objections, once used sparingly around the country to get exempted from various required vaccines, are becoming a much more widely used loophole against the COVID-19 shot, and it is only likely to grow following President Joe Biden's sweeping new vaccine mandates covering more than 100 million Americans, including executive branch employees and workers at businesses with more than 100 people on the payroll. The administration acknowledges that a small minority of Americans will use, and some may seek to exploit, religious exemptions, but it said it believes even marginal improvements in vaccine rates will save lives. It is not clear how many federal employees have asked for a religious exemption, though union officials say there will be many requests. The Labor Department has said an accommodation can be denied, if it causes an undue burden on the employer. In the states, mask and vaccine requirements vary, but most offer exemptions for certain medical conditions or religious or philosophical objections. The use of such exemptions, particularly by parents on behalf of their school children, has been growing over the past decade. The allowance was enshrined in the Federal Civil Rights Act of 1964, which says employers must make reasonable accommodations for employees who object to work requirements because of sincerely held religious beliefs. A religious belief does not have to be recognized by an organized religion, and it can be new, unusual, or seem illogical or unreasonable to others, according to rules laid out by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. But it can't be founded solely on political or social ideas. That puts employers in the position of determining what is a legitimate religious belief and what is a dodge. Many major religious denominations have no objections to the COVID-19 vaccines, but the rollout has prompted heated debates because of the long-time role that cell lines derived from fetal tissue have played directly or indirectly in the research and development of various vaccines and medicines. All right, to wind up the day, we're going to go to Dear Abby, and there are three letters today. The headline says, Hungry Family Can't Stomach Birthday Barbecue. Dear Abby, I was deeply hurt after going to a barbecue at my oldest daughter's home. It was to celebrate my granddaughter's 4th birthday. My daughter's husband is from Thailand. He barbecued beautiful dishes of shrimp and something that looked like a gigantic crawfish. While my daughter is accustomed to and enjoys this food, she and her husband are aware that I, my husband, and her sister and her niece are not accustomed to it. We simply do not like the flavor and texture. When I asked my daughter if there were any hot dogs they could grill, at least for my 9-year-old granddaughter, she got angry and said she eats what her husband cooks. I felt our part of the family was not even being considered. I was hurt for my youngest daughter and my other granddaughter, who had literally nothing to eat that they would even remotely like. Am I wrong for feeling ignored being invited to a barbecue where my daughter knew all the food offered were things we wouldn't like? Signed, Ruined My Appetite. And Abby responds, Dear Ruined, I do think you are blowing this out of proportion. I assume you have been invited to your daughter's and son-in-law's before and knew her husband does the cooking. Before coming over, you should have asked if it would be all right to bring a few traditional American dishes with you for the children. If your offer was refused, you could have skipped the barbecue. That said, look at the big picture. It was only one afternoon. I assume the kids were taken out for burgers or hot dogs afterward, and no serious harm was done. The next letter begins, Dear Abby, I am a news nut. Since adolescence, I have loved watching the news and staying informed about current events. I also have had a problem since childhood. When I see a person get an injection, I have a physical reaction. I shiver from head to toe. Because of the pandemic, I can no longer watch news broadcasts because they constantly show folks getting vaccinated. Does anyone else have the same reaction? Any suggestions? Signed, Squeamish in Canada. And Abby responds, Dear Squeamish, I'm sure that more people than you think have significant reactions regarding needles. A dear friend of mine must lie down before any procedure involving a needle because she faints. In your case, because news anchors usually announce before commercial breaks what will be featured right after this important message from our sponsor, take note of it and turn your head, change the channel, or leave the TV until the next segment. And then the final letter begins, Dear Abby, what do you do with a large family picture of yourself, your husband, your son, your daughter-in-law, who is no longer your daughter-in-law? She and my son divorced after 9 years of marriage. He has since remarried. I don't want to hang the picture, but I don't know what to do with it. Any help would be appreciated. Signed, Out of the Picture in Alabama. And Abby responds, Try this. Reach out to your former daughter-in-law and ask whether she would like to have the picture. If she is interested, offer it to her. If she's not, feel free to toss it. All right, that does it for the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Monday, September 20th. Thank you for listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thank you for listening.